This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 25 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
David, it's 25 episodes. That's practically half a year. It's hard to believe that we've been doing this that long. It's gone awfully quickly, but I guess that's what happens when you're talking about something that's changing and advancing so quickly.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. It's 12 and a half hours worth of audio, if you look at it that way, too. So, yeah, we're considering it was this time last year that I sort of jokingly said we need to do this. And it's kind of amazing that 25 episodes in and lots of great listeners and lots of great comments. But we probably should get going and not keep patting ourselves on the back. So for our topics tonight, we're going to talk about drones for defense. The Navy wants a CPB Predator B rustles up a conviction. Drones go nuke. A quadcopter that thinks it's a Falcon. The AMA, or the Academy of Model Aeronautics, and the FAA come together. I feel like playing the Beatles on that one. Come together right now.
Yes.
And spotting a fire. And lastly, we've got a lot of listener mail, so we've got a full show, Max, so I guess we better get started.
All right, David, let's get started.
So our first article tonight comes from the United States Naval Institute Press, and it's drones for countermeasures, rethinking drone strategy. The UCAV, or the Unmanned Combat Air Vehicle, can be used to protect the carrier battle fleet. We've been talking about drones as offensive weapons, and that's partly where the bad reputation comes from, Predators and Reapers launching missile attacks. But the Navy is looking at it a little differently, as you use the manned aircraft for the offense and you keep the UCAVs back to protect the heavies, the carrier battle fleet. So what do you think about that, Max? A little role reversal.
Yeah, that's interesting. What do you think, David, are some of the missions that drones could undertake in this countermeasure or this defensive kind of posture?
What we're talking about is protecting the fleet. You used to have combat air patrols like Tomcats, where they would protect the fleet, and the Phoenix missile system was designed to shoot down cruise missiles. Well, in this case, you don't have the men flying these long missions protecting the battle fleet, but you have unmanned aerial vehicles. And every aircraft carrier and cruiser has chafe and close-in weapon systems, but if they are under sustained attack, they're going to run out. So you still use the UAVs, and the worst that will happen is the UAV will run out of gas and crash into the sea, but it'll still be protecting the fleet. And using drones as decoys is not something new. I put in our show notes that the ADM-20 Quail decoy used to be dropped out of a B-52, and each little Quail, which was a tiny little airplane, a drone, would fly off, and it would look like, to the Russians, three B-52s flying in formation away from the other ones to act as a shoot me, not shoot the actual aircraft. So you could imagine that a B-52 could carry a couple of these in their weapons, and they would launch them as they flew over into enemy territory, and suddenly the whole battle fleet grew from three airplanes to 22 airplanes. So you have to pick your targets. And UAVs could be used the same way. They make big targets and they stay away and take the fight away from the fleet.
Now, do you think that this is a way to sort of reduce the risk to personnel Or is this motivated by a lower cost method to provide these kinds of missions? Do you have any ideas on that, David?
A little bit of both. I mean, the interesting aspect was that the article references the fact that for flying offensive missions, it might be better to have still a pilot in the cockpit to make the final decisions. Whereas the drones defending the fleet, you could be more autonomous and you don't have the necessity that you would about to taking the shot or not. They're there as a defensive weapon. So it's an interesting way of looking at strategy, and the Navy will probably find a way of doing both with their new aircraft.
I kind of get the sense that the Navy is devoting more energy and resources to unmanned than maybe some of the other branches of the military. Is that an accurate kind of perception?
I don't know. The Navy is looking at it. They're always looking for a new way to look over the horizon, and they're taking that on with the fire scouts, the MQ-8B and C, the aircraft carrier landings of the UCAV. The Air Force is pretty much ingrained. Their bread and butter is jet fighters and jet bombers and pilots. Mm. The Navy doesn't have to cater to a definite portion of their population. So it may be political, but the Army's just as involved with drones, but they're a lot smaller. They're talking about. So each service is trying to find its niche and their uses. And like one of the articles that came out over the last week was the Pentagon is saying to the Navy, the Army, and the Air Force, maybe you need to rethink your strategies because a lot of, excuse the pun, blurred lines, to use the pop song, have occurred over this war on terror over the last 10, 15 years, where the Navy and the Air Force and the Army have roles where they sort of morph together, and there needs to probably go back to being some more delineation between who does what and where. So,
all right. Well, we should probably push ahead. We have an item here in Fox News, we see, where David, a sheriff, asked the Customs and Border Patrol to monitor a farmer, and they had a little excitement associated with that, and it was a drone mixed in, didn't they?
Yeah. A couple episodes back, we talked about that the Customs and Border Patrol announced that they were farming out their predator bees, which in military parlances are Reapers or MQ-9s, but they're not able to carry weapons. But the Customs and Border Patrol were using them for various things. And one of the stories actually was this farm. Rodney Brossart had a 3,000-acre farm, and he was accused by his neighbors of good old-fashioned American cattle rustling. the neighbor's cattle would stray over, and he would keep them and not return them. This is why we have brands. But after he was reported, the sheriff went in and they actually had an armed standoff. And eventually, after the armed standoff, the sheriff asked the Customs and Border Patrol if they would fly some missions over the guy's 3,000-acre farm to gather some evidence. And in November 2011, Brossart was charged not with cattle rustling, but the predator did show had video of the armed standoff. So he was given 6-month jail time based on the video. So this is the first real arrest based on drone footage.
Yeah, a definite police action. I think it's kind of ironic. It's kind of amusing, as you say, that he was not found guilty of rustling the cows, but that standoff with the authorities is what did him in. But yeah, I can anticipate these kinds of uses for UAS in the future to a great degree. I mean, this is a really powerful weapon in the arsenal, if you will, of the authorities.
Yeah, it's good old fashioned surveillance from the air. It's hard to stake out 3,000 acres, but having a Reaper doing orbits over that property is pretty easy. So it was very interesting use. But speaking of monitoring, we should talk about the Fukushima plant being monitored for drones for radiation leaks, huh?
This plant took a hit in the tsunami that devastated Japan and killed thousands of people. And the Fukushima nuclear power plant was one of the casualties of that tsunami. And part of the problem involved the release of radioactive material to the extent that the place was just not safe for humans. It exceeded the limits. So how do you get in there and take a look at what's going on, and how do you monitor radiation levels specifically? And they've found a drone as being perfect for that application.
And this makes perfect sense given what we've talked about over the last half year. Drones are going to be used in high-risk areas, and you don't want to send somebody into a nuclear reactor that, for all intents and purposes, is melting down. But surveying drones over the area, perfectly good use to measure the radiation and, if necessary, disposable.
I think they used some quadcopter, multicopter kinds of equipment early on to sort of assess the situation, give them an eye into the plant. And I think what's happened here is that in terms of monitoring radiation levels, this is an application for a fixed wing UAS. And in this case, they want to be able to position the drone in specific locations, run through a specific course so that they can measure the radiation, and so that it's repeatable with each measurement cycle. So here we see a fixed wing UAS being used. So yeah, like you say, David, perfect application. Too dangerous for humans. Let's send in the drone.
And that brings us to our next drone. We talk about surveillance, and what one of those things that has come up is a drone that can go stick on a wall or be the proverbial fly on the wall. And we have an article from the newscientist.com that has a drone with the legs that can perch, watch, and walk like a bird. So we've got a quadcopter with claws, huh, Max?
Yeah, multicopters generally don't have very sophisticated landing gear. As we know, usually it's just an extension that keeps the craft from crashing without sustaining too much damage, but it's not really a very sophisticated landing gear. So after studying some bird landings using some high-speed video, I believe, a Brighton, Massachusetts company, Vishwa Robotics, they've been developing basically legs modeled after the American Kestrel, and they've put these on the quadcopter. There's a video in this article where the thing, it's a short video, but the thing rises up, hovers, and then sort of goes and sticks to perches to an object, and it's very odd. I mean, when I look at this thing, David, I just think this is a kind of mechanical behavior that I'm not used to seeing.
Well, yeah, the Kestrel, the legs have basically a grapple like you would see a hawk or an eagle's claws, and it grapples onto the perch. But they could talk about things like picking up objects or, for surveillance, being able to stick to a wall and stay there and not use the power of the rotors, but actually use the power of the claws to stay there to keep one point surveilled, which would be good for things like monitoring if you start having, like we are having, ice storms around here and you're having faulty transformers. You could fly one of these near the transformer to monitor it to make sure it's there, and you could keep it there for a length of time without it sitting there hovering. And it's basically stealth. So we're going to have little stealth helicopters now that'll be able to stick to walls and become, like I just said, the proverbial fly on the wall. And we'll all get to see it. So pretty neat technology. I definitely suggest that you go look at the video, short be it.
Yeah, and this is another example, I think, of sort of the interesting creative stuff that's that's happening in this industry right now. I mean, just take this one little, you know, bit of functionality, and you just start to think of the applications that could take advantage of this and where that will lead us, where we haven't been before. It's just one more example of, you know, what's happening in this in this industry. It's fascinating. It really is an exciting time.
It is. And speaking of really exciting news, we got this from listener Chris. We got a memorandum of understanding. I always wonder about those things, but Academy of Model Aeronautics and the FAA are talking, and they're actually trying to work together to come up with some solutions for small UASs, huh?
Yeah, and this could be extremely important and have a lot of implications. As the FAA and all of us sort of struggle with the regulations, the requirements that are hopefully to come in the not-too-distant future, there's always a conversation around hobbyists and models. And, you know, isn't there some level below which it doesn't need regulation by the FAA? And we see that right now with the activities that the AMA takes part in. And so as we start to look at unmanned aircraft, it's great that these two organizations are coming together. Now, an MOU, I mean, it doesn't have a whole lot of teeth, and it definitely doesn't have results. But what it is a commitment to work together. And I think that's pretty significant. I just hope that, you know, besides the or beyond the signing ceremony, that we see some action and some activity.
Well, I mentioned the AMA from day one, being from the hobbyist standpoint. They've been around a long time, and they're really good at governing the hobby. So them and the Academy of Model Rocketry are two organizations that have standards set up that the UAV industry, or at least the hobbyist UAV industry, could model them after. So this is really great news, and you and I have been talking, like last week, we talked about standards and things set up, and this is just one more thing, and this is groundbreaking that the FAA is reaching out to outside organizations to help them set up standards. So good for the FAA, even better for the AMA, because they know what they're doing. And look forward to watching this grow, and hopefully good things will grow out of it.
Yeah, for sure. And hopefully soon. Hopefully soon.
Yeah, we keep hoping every day. But you know what, Max? The longer they take, the more we have to talk about.
So I guess so.
There's a positive spin on it. Yeah. But so evidently, the next story was another one from our new favorite listener suggestion, Miss Flight. So you want to tackle this one?
Sure. This one is pretty simple. This is from the Hartford Current. And the firefighters responded to a fire in a quarry. And the situation was they were doing some blasting in the quarry. And so they had some blast mats, which, if you're not familiar with those, they're really heavy rubber, usually made out of recycled and shredded automobile tires. They had some of those mats that apparently caught fire. The problem was that also in the quarry was dynamite. And the firefighters weren't sure if the fire was near the dynamite and if it was even safe to go in there. So what did they do? Well, one of their volunteers had brought a quadcopter to the station to show the folks, and they remembered that. So this volunteer hadn't been one of those responding, but they got a hold of him, and he brought his. I think what he had is a DJI Phantom, and I'll take a guess with probably a GoPro hanging from it. And so they were able
that would be the typical guess anymore for any of these kind of things would be a DJI Phantom with a GoPro.
That's right. So they flew this thing over, and they determined that the fire was not next to or near the dynamite, and so that it was safe to go in and deal with the fire, which they did. So, you know, yet again, another example of a situation, in this case, a very dangerous situation. I don't think they would have sent anybody in there until they knew for sure that the whole thing wasn't going to explode. And they were able to just use a very simple device, basically, easily and quickly assess the situation and take action based on that.
Ah, but that's illegal, isn't it?
Yeah. So hence the dilemma. I mean, I think that nobody could argue that this was unsafe or a bad situation to be flying a mission like this. I mean, that's the reason why you'd want to bring in the quadcopter and the camera. You need to get an eye. Now, you could say that, well, okay, you could bring in a conventional helicopter, but think of the time it would take to get that. Think of the expense. This and the safety of the firefighters. It just made sense. This is the right way to deal with it. But yeah, so there's pressure to do this or not. I think we're finding a lot of folks are not fully aware of the limitations that the FAA is demanding these days. And I think that there are probably quite a few people who are out there using UAVs to accomplish things that make sense and that are the right thing to do. And, you know, it's tough. I don't know what the FAA is thinking. I mean, they must be looking at all this and wondering how can they deal with this? I mean, the phrase is, you know, the horse is already out of the barn. You can't go backwards. I don't know. I don't know where it's going to go.
Which is kind of a perfect, the fire there is a perfect segue to our first listener mail from Neil Clary, who sent us a video of an aftermath of a wildfire in Norway, and we'll put that in our show notes. He started off with, "Hi, airplane, I mean UAV geeks." Now, we haven't gone by UAV geeks, but we'll take it. His comment is the UAV seems tailor-made for wildfire work, and I think we agree, but it's not only the United States, but several countries. We had an Australian story, whereas somebody was trying to use a UAV to help wildfires, and they got grounded ASAP. So we'll put a link to the YouTube notes on that. And the next one is from Sam. Sam was the guy we said last week told us the story about the light beer. That's why the hexacopter could carry the beer so well. Well, he sent us a follow-on email about, believe it or not, someone started a White House petition to let that little drone copter deliver its beer. So, Max, did you put your name to that petition?
Not yet, but I think I had better. This is at, we'll put the link in the show notes, but there's this petitions.whitehouse.gov. And if folks aren't familiar with it, it's a vehicle by which anybody can create a petition. And there's some threshold of signatures. If it reaches a certain number of signatures, then it actually is supposed to go to the White House and they're supposed to respond to it in some way or another. It doesn't mean they're going to follow the recommendations of the petition, but they will at least look at it and answer it. So it's based on numbers. If you're inclined to support this, take a look at the show notes and we'll have the petition link right there.
And we got another email from Graham Hartridge. He has a UAV company called Blue Visual Productions. We do aerial photography and video plus assessments. And he's flying a Dragonfly X6 UAV. And he says he loves the podcast. So we'll put a link in the show notes. And again, Graham, where it's one of those, you're doing visual production, so I'm assuming you're not flying the quadcopter, you're just doing photography of it, correct? And we'll leave it at that. And I think that wraps it up for, we did hear back from Manny, didn't we, Max?
Yes, we did, Manny Cohn. This is relates back to episode 22, and a number of listeners wrote in asking about or asking for more details on commercial use, in this case, real estate use of drones. And Manny wrote back, and he made a couple of points. For one, he is kind of focused on the things that we need to be doing in order to, in the future, allow commercial application of unmanned vehicles. So he's focused on things like, what should the training requirements be? He's focused on for those companies that will ensure these kinds of operations, what requirements should they have and how should that proceed, and things like that. So we'd invite you to take a look at Manny's response. Again, that's in episode 22. If you want to go easily right to that post, you can use the shortcut theuavdigest.com/22, and you'll see Manny's response there.
Well, episode 25 is pretty much done. I guess we should go through the usual routine about, if you're going to the website is theuavdigest.com. At Twitter, it's at @UAVDigest. Facebook, it's @UAVDigest. And of course, our email is
feedback@theuavdigest.com.
And remember, if you like us, go to iTunes and leave us a favorable, hopefully, review. And or you can stream us to your phone using Stitcher.com. So I guess the chicken's done and fried, so I guess we should call it a night, huh, Max?
I guess we should. So this is Max in Hartford.
And David in Philly.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening.